Would you like to reserve some time for rebuttal, Ms. Spalding?
Yes, please. 3 minutes.
Certainly.
May it please the court. I am here on behalf of Santron Speller, the appellant. Mr. Speller was convicted of 2 counts of burglary, 2 counts of conspiracy, and 2 counts of grand larceny of a firearm in the Virginia Beach Circuit Court. In starting with the third assignment of error, grand larceny of a firearm, I'm asking the court to dismiss those because the court ultimately found that the Commonwealth did not prove that the firearms or the items that appeared to be firearms that were introduced at trial were actually firearms under the definition of the code. So section 18.2-308.2, possession of a firearm by a convicted felon.
Is it your argument that the acquittal on the possession charge of necessity required an acquittal on the larceny charge?
Yes, I believe the court made a finding of fact that the Commonwealth did not prove that the items that were admitted into evidence, the photographs, were actual firearms under the definition of a firearm. And I presented the Armstrong case to that effect. I submit that the court must adopt that same definition under the grand larceny code so that when the Commonwealth is attempting to prove grand larceny of a firearm, they are required to follow that particular definition. So when Judge Croshaw made a finding of fact that that was not proven for the one particular charge, that same finding of fact would apply to the grand larceny of a firearm.
This is, in effect, a collateral estoppel type of argument.
Yes.
Isn't the case law pretty clear that collateral estoppel does not apply in a simultaneous prosecution?
Yes, it can. But at the same time, I think...
No, our case law is that it does not apply in a simultaneous prosecution.
Yes, you are correct.
It does preclude the court in a subsequent prosecution from making a different finding of fact, but not in the same prosecution.
That is true. And the court could easily say that if the definition of firearm does not apply to grand larceny, then Judge Croshaw could have relied on other factors that were presented in evidence.
Well, couldn't the court have acquitted the defendant on the charge just out of an act of mercy?
Yes, but I definitely got the feeling when he said that the evidence was overwhelming on the other charges that the court did not have that feeling towards my client at the time.
Juries, for instance, often come back with inconsistent verdicts that have been upheld by this court. They'll come back and find the defendant not guilty of the underlying felony, but convict him of use of the firearm in the commission of that felony.
Absolutely.
And we've upheld those kinds of inconsistent verdicts as long as the facts support the conviction that was had.
But I don't think this was an inconsistent verdict, because the case of Armstrong was presented to Judge Croshaw. He went in the back to read the case. He came out, and he specifically asked me whether or not that definition that was listed in Armstrong of what a firearm means applies to grand larceny of a firearm, which indicated to me during argument that he didn't know the answer to it, and that I had not, or the Commonwealth had not, presented him a case that would have ultimately guided him in that regard. So I don't think it's an inconsistent verdict. I don't think that he had a case that would tell him one way or the other. Now, I argued that I felt that the definition did, in fact, apply to grand larceny. The Commonwealth had nothing, to dispute that or support that, and he made the ruling that it did not.
Blanco testified he had fired his gun a month earlier.
He had indicated that he had fired it several months prior. But what did he fire? I don't know. Hmm? There were no specifics about that. The gun, gun was not...
To me, that means it's operable. It's certainly a reasonable inference, isn't it?
It can be, but operability is not required. Under the particular definition of firearm as listed in the 308 particular
it's
sections,
designed to
expel the projectile.
Well, even more so, you fire it, it seems to me that's designed to fire a projectile.
But that testimony did not come in from Mr. Baer on that hand.
But the Supreme Court in Jordan held that you can prove that an item is a firearm under the requisite definition by circumstantial evidence.
I kind of disagree with Jordan, and that's because Jordan was a jury verdict. And I think...
I may disagree with Jordan, too, but I'm going to follow it.
Oh, absolutely, and I understand
that. The evidence in this case is, and I'm talking about just looking at the circumstantial evidence, the victims described the guns as an AR-15 Sheridan, a Ruger SR-45 .45 caliber automatic double-barrel shotgun made in Spain. He kept the guns in a gun safe. He kept them with ammunition. Isn't all of that circumstantially sufficient to establish that these items were, in fact, designed and intended to expel the ammunition that he kept with him?
I disagree. So the Jordan case goes with the use of a firearm, a carjacking, and a possession of a weapon by the felon. In Jordan, the court not only lists what the victim described in terms of it being a Raven 25 caliber semi-automatic pistol, but they also cite the Red case. And in both Red and Jordan, there were implied threats by the individual holding the weapon that the weapon could be used.
But that's not required, is it? That's just one circumstantial element that the trier of fact may consider.
Yes, but that is what the court relied on to support why the definition of firearm didn't come in. They said, well, in Red, not only, it said here that Arrowwood, while directing him to get out of the car, most assuredly communicated the message that if Arrowwood did not comply, Jordan would shoot him. And in Red, it said, Red stated that he would kill the clerk if an alarm were activated. So there were both implied statements from the perpetrators in those cases that suggested that that particular firearm was operable at the time.
A witness testified, MB testified, that the stolen handgun was loaded with ammunition and kept out of sight on a shelf in the closet. Now, why, I mean, the fact that the owner would keep it, quote, loaded with ammunition, isn't that a circumstantial fact that when you pull the trigger, that ammunition was coming out of the barrel?
Potentially, but again, that evidence did not come in. And the firearms were not physically presented for the court in order to review them.
The evidence did not come in.
The firearm did not come in. So there was one testimony about the firearm. A photo was shown of the firearm,
oh,
which
you
is
mean
a,
the actual firearm.
Yes, sir. So in that particular case, you may say, manipulate the firearm. Use your bailiff to show that the magazine can come out. What bullets were actually loaded into
well,
that? That did not come in.
It doesn't have to be designed and intended to fire. It doesn't have to actually be capable of firing.
Very true. But I don't feel that the testimony specifically of Mr. Baer and Mr. Blanco meets the definition that the court has required under 18.2308.2. I mean, we've adopted a lesser standard for the use of a firearm code. We've adopted a lesser standard when we feel that the perpetrator wants to bring some type of violence against the victim. So in a use of a firearm, it's not so much about it being a firearm. It's about the use portion. It's about deterring that violent contact. But in the possession particular charges, it's all about whether or not it's that actual firearm. And that's why that definition is specifically put in there. It's in multiple code sections. So I think we first have to adopt that under 18.2953, that definition applies because there's nothing in that code section that suggests you're trying to deter violent conduct from another party. In fact, that's a theft that's happening not on or about a person, but that's a theft that is seemingly completely away from the victim at that time. So if that definition applies, then the question becomes, well, was the definition in this case met? And that's where I submit that it was not.
I want to get back just for a moment to your argument about the trial court acquittal on the charge of possession of a firearm by a convicted felon.
Yes, sir.
Could that verdict have been predicated on the lack of evidence of possession as opposed to lack of evidence that the item was a firearm?
I disagree.
I'm asking you.
Oh, yes. I mean, it could have. But the Commonwealth's evidence was that that particular firearm had Mr. Speller's fingerprint on it. So that's how they attributed possession specifically to him. And when I made my motion to strike and presented the sole case of Armstrong, I only argued on that issue of whether or not it met the elements listed in Armstrong.
But did the trial court specifically state, I am concluding that this is not a firearm under the statute, or did it just announce a verdict of acquittal?
I believe he announced, and I would have to go back through the record, but I know he said that he disagreed with the Court of Appeals in Armstrong. So I had argued that these are the two elements that you have to prove for that charge. Judge Kroshaw came back that he disagreed with that particular element being necessary, but ultimately he felt that that element was not proven, and he dismissed that particular charge. I've also asked the court to dismiss the other charges of conspiracy, one conspiracy, and two burglaries. Most importantly, because the first burglary in this particular case that happened with Mr. Blanco happened sometime between 8:15 in the morning and 12:30. There's no evidence at all that places any particular people in that home. All the evidence would be considered recent possession evidence from when the three men were stopped in the car at roughly 12:45 that afternoon. Now, it was believed
that the car contained stolen items from these particular houses, didn't it?
It did, in multiple locations. Many of them in the trunk and the firearm underneath the driver's seat, where Mr. Speller, at least the Commonwealth argued, was sitting because that's where his fingerprint was. However, to have a conspiracy, you have to show that there is an agreement between two parties in order to enter that particular home. Although the three of them are placed together at 12:45 in the afternoon with some of that property, we have zero evidence presented to show that actually two people went into that home or that those parties were together earlier in the day when someone went into Mr. Blanco's home. So you could suggest that, well, because they're all together 4 hours later, it's just as plausible that one particular party went into the home of Mr. Blanco at 8:15 in the morning, met up with the others, and then ultimately the three of them committed the burglary at Mr. Bear's home. There's no fingerprints found in Mr. Blanco's home. There's no footprints. There's no DNA. So the Commonwealth presented zero evidence to suggest the number of people that went into that home or the number of people that exited that home with property.
You don't have to prove the agreement by direct evidence. You can prove it by circumstantial evidence. And we have the witness who saw the three of them in the area, apparently casing homes. I think she saw a, quote, box load of stuff in the car. Saw the burglars carry a box load of stuff from the home and put it in the car in the Buick. I mean, isn't all of this circumstantial evidence that A, there was an agreement, and B, that it was executed?
Well, that's for the second one, absolutely. The second one, they're not caught in the act. They're caught as the officer kind of trails them out of the neighborhood and stops them. But you have a 3 to 4 hour time frame there. We have no idea where these three men were or what they were doing, when they got in the car, whose car it was. All you have
isn't that evidence in the car.
Isn't
this burglary circumstantial evidence that they were on the prowl in the neighborhood and breaking into houses, particularly when the stolen property is found in their possession?
There was nothing unique about the two burglaries to suggest that there was a common modus operandi. The doors were in, property was taken. It's relatively different property for both of them.
Were guns taken in both?
Yes, sir, but only one gun in one, and I believe several in the other.
And
I'd ask.
How about the testimony when arrested wearing underwear and a sock that he was out jogging? Isn't that something that the court can consider a lie that the defendant told the police in order to conceal his guilt?
The court can absolutely consider that, but I think that the evidence was much stronger regarding the second burglary of Mr. Bear's home than it was regarding the first, and I'd ask to reserve my remaining time.
It's amazing how we all need these glasses.
I know. I'm getting a little long of tooth here.
Justice is blind, but not intelligence, right?
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Rosemary Bourne on behalf of the appellee, the Commonwealth of Virginia. I would first like to talk about that conspiracy charge and talk about the similarities between these two crimes. There were medications, and not medications like controlled substances that people normally take to get high, but blood pressure medications and things like that taken from both homes, which is pretty unusual. And they were found in the vehicle from both Mr. Blanco's home, and I believe some of these things were found on the way outside of Mr. Bear's home.
Ms. Barton, I appreciate your leading with your strength, and that's certainly good appellate advocacy. But I'm more interested in talking, and I want to spend some time talking about the issue of the firearm. The two questions involve, A, which definition should be applied, because I think we all agree that there is no case law on the larceny of a firearm statute, and then, B, whether the trial court's acquittal on the possession of the firearm charges constitute a collateral estoppel to preclude a conviction of possession?
Absolutely, Your Honor, but I would first say that a collateral estoppel argument, or as I read this, a inconsistent verdict argument, neither of those arguments were presented in the assignment of error. There's a straight sufficiency argument made here. And I think that nor were these arguments clearly made at the trial court level. I mean, if she believed that he was precluded from finding, that the trial court was precluded from finding these verdicts because they were inconsistent, or because, he was collaterally estopped from doing so, that argument needed to be made to the trial court so that he could further explain his ruling. And neither of those arguments were clearly made, nor are they encompassed by the assignment of error. So I don't believe that they're properly before this court. Having said that, I'm happy to talk about the merits here. The real problem with this entire argument is that we're talking about Armstrong when the most recent case, which I think was the game changer, is Jordan. And in fact, the trial court, Jordan wasn't even cited or mentioned by the trial court. So the trial court, unfortunately, is being led down this path as if there's a certain requirement and mechanistic language and differences between these two statutes that has really been eviscerated, I would argue, since Jordan. Because what Jordan essentially stood for, I think, is that, look, there's no mechanistic way that you have to prove something is a firearm.
But before we get to that, you argue initially, correct me if I'm wrong, that we should apply the definition of firearm that is found in the use of the firearm, is applied in the use of the firearm in the commission of a felony and brandishing, do you not?
Well, my argument is that 18.295 does not specifically require any particular definition of a firearm. And there's a good reason for that. The reason being that in the vast majority of cases, we do not recover firearms. So the notion that a larceny victim, that you would have to have expert testimony, how could they possibly opine whether something was designed to expel
normally,
a firearm?
I mean, you don't recover the firearm, but as in many cases, you have a witness, the owner of the firearm, who can tell you what that was.
Exactly, as they did here. But can an owner really say something is designed to expel a projectile? I don't think that they can actually testify to that.
Right,
I don't think they're qualified to do so.
If I go to the local gun shop, I don't go there to buy a toy gun, and I suspect most of these people, if nothing more, could testify that they had to fill out the federal firearms form when they purchased the firearm.
Right, and that's why the concerns that are present when somebody presents an item and we don't know that it's actually a firearm, like during a robbery, the concern.
If we apply the looks alike is good enough, which is what we use in, say, use of a firearm in the commission of a felony, that if it had the appearance of a firearm, it's sufficient. Both that and the brandishing charge are crimes where the firearm induces fear in the mind of a victim, a person who is presented with a firearm.
But
that's not the case here.
But my problem with that is I think Jordan eviscerated that distinction.
Except Jordan, part of the facts were that the defendant pointed the gun at the victim.
That's absolutely true, but that is not the only way that you can prove something is a firearm. And the concern in that case is the concern that's absent here. Hey, look, owner of a firearm.
You want to adopt a standard that says basically that if it appears to be a firearm, for purposes of larceny, it is a firearm.
What I'm asking you to adopt is that when the owner of a firearm that knows what the item is gets up there and says, this is a firearm, then it's a firearm.
Right,
it's not that it appears to be a firearm.
That's proving through circumstantial evidence.
Exactly.
That is designed and intended.
Exactly.
But you're not asking us to say if a 15-year-old kid steals a plastic toy gun that looks all the world like a real one, it's grand larceny.
Of course not. I'm not saying that. I don't think that's what happened here. What I'm saying is the same concerns that you have, the same concerns about the quality of the circumstantial evidence that you have when you present an...
The statute is designed to prevent the larceny of a dangerous instrument. just as in the possession of a firearm by a convicted felon, the court has held that the intent of the statute is to prevent possession by of a dangerous weapon. It has to be a dangerous weapon.
I don't know that that's the intent of the statute. The intent of the statute could be that it's difficult to prove values of the firearm, and that's why we want to make, we don't want to have a value. We don't have to prove value. I don't know that that's the intent of the statute, and I don't think that there's evidence to show what the intent of the statute is. But I would say here, regardless, that the circumstantial evidence, when you have an owner of a firearm who knows what his, he describes them as weapons, gives detailed explanations about what these items are, and at least in one case it had recently been fired. Let's just think for, this is, I would argue, very similar to value. When you have a person testifying to the value of, an owner testifying to the value of their own property, they are allowed to do so because they know the value of their own property. Here, these people know what these items are. They're firearms. They have ammunition. They describe them in detail. One of them had previously shot them and said that it was operable. The notion that it is almost ridiculous to say that if the firearm is not found, how then would you prove that it's an operable firearm? Because certainly an expert without even seeing it can't say
but
it's
it
operable. How can they even say it's designed? They can't see it. It's all they're hearing is that it's described as a firearm.
Let me ask you about the second issue, and that's the effect of the court's acquittal. The court just said after hearing argument of counsel specifically on which definition of a firearm to apply, the court simply said the court, based on argument of counsel and the case law supplied, is going to dismiss the possession of a firearm charge. And then he goes on to convict on the other charge, and his last statement is, I do believe that's a different code section not governed by that, which appears to be speaking to the definition of a firearm.
Okay, so he's wrong. So he's legally wrong. That's not a factual finding. The fact that he is wrong about the law and hadn't read Jordan, and mainly because none of the parties cited Jordan.
I'm getting hung up. He has acquitted the defendant of possession of an instrument designed and intended to expel a projectile. How then can he convict the defendant of an instrument designed and intended to expel a projectile?
Well, we don't. I think what you said earlier is absolutely correct. We do not know why he acquitted him of that. He does not say.
It's a general verdict?
We don't know. I think that's part of the problem here, illustrates that this particular argument was not fairly presented to the trial court in a way that he could have addressed it and maybe made more sense of this. And I cited a case, when you argue inconsistent verdicts, you actually have to present that argument to the trial court to give them an opportunity to address that. And that was not done here. And I also would argue it's almost like approbate and reprobate. When you tell someone that a certain thing is required to prove, and that's not actually accurate, that's not the only way to prove it, and it's wrong, and then the judge gets hung up on what the definition is, and then you come back and say, look, oh, now you're collaterally stopped from doing this. There's a real problem with that.
Does collateral estoppel apply in a simultaneous process?
No, Your Honor. I did not read this. I will be frank. I did not read this as a collateral estoppel argument.
I'm going there only because it's I guess, the closest I can come. It's inconsistent verdict, but does inconsistent verdict really apply in a bench trial?
Well, you can't have inconsistent verdicts in a bench trial, but you also have to make that argument to the court. And we don't know that these are inconsistent verdicts because we don't know the reasons why he dismissed that charge. So for a variety of reasons, I think that that's, extremely problematic to be diving down into that when these issues were not clearly presented. As to the burglary, I would just argue that there were similarities here beyond what were mentioned, and I just wanted to mention a few things. I have a minute, I see. Medications were the same. The clothes were strewn all over the house in both of these burglaries. Really, when you look at the photographs, it was beyond just what was necessary to steal things. Both entries were made through the back door. There were handguns taken in both. All of these items were found in the car where all three of these perpetrators were. They were wearing hoodies, and hoodies were found in the car. It was actually in a very short time frame, within between 8 in the morning and 12. And I think that the circumstantial evidence suggests that all of this took place, that the first burglary took place before the second burglary, because it was only a very short time frame, if you look at that last text message and the time frame on that, before they were actually pulled over. There's been a lot of this mention in here, and I wanted to address this, about the fact that only two people were seen driving by in the car. Well, the officer only saw two people, too, and then followed the car and didn't lose sight of it, and three people got out. So somebody was either laying down in the back seat or couldn't be seen because of windows, or there was some...
And his jogging clothes.
Something was going on, exactly. And then, of course, you have the suspicious behavior afterwards and his lying about what he's doing. I mean, he's seen getting out of the car in regular clothes. He runs from the officer. He's found a very short time later wearing underwear and a sock, and lies about...
I believe this occurred in February.
Exactly, Your Honor, and has a completely unbelievable story about what he's doing wearing those clothes. I mean, he was probably running, but he wasn't running for recreation. I think he was running to get away from the officers in this case. So unless the court has further questions for me, I would just ask that you affirm.
Thank you.
Could you address Ms. Bourne's argument that the issue of inconsistent verdicts was not preserved?
Page 284, it was. So basically on 284, Judge Kroshaw specifically says that he agreed with the Court of Appeals ruling that I presented. He said it does not matter the operational status of the gun, but the statute is clear and ambiguous that it must be shown to, by explosion, project a projectile, to expel a projectile. And then he specifically asked me whether or not that same definition applied.
But did you make the argument, the specific argument, that having now acquitted him of possession of the firearm, you cannot now convict him of larceny of that firearm?
I did not, because I believe that in explaining to him that I believe that that definition applied to both statutes, that the two either or the three charges all had to go one way, or they had to go the other.
How about your assignment of error? Does that encompass, is that simply a sufficiency assignment, or does it encompass the legal concept of inconsistent verdicts?
The assignment of error is only a sufficiency concept. Specifically,
does that limit you in what you can argue?
I disagree. Because we're determining what the definition of a firearm is under 18.295. And if that definition that is in the code in other sections applies to 18.295, then that evidence...
Well, if we agree with you on that point, that the intended definition applies, and we also conclude that the evidence, the circumstantial evidence, is sufficient to meet that definition, do we then have to affirm?
I believe so. But I feel that if you find that the definition applies and you accept Judge Kroshaw's ruling that was a factual finding he made, that it was not evidence of an intention to expel a projectile by means of explosion, if you believe that that factual finding is correct, then you would have to dismiss.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We will come down and recounsel.